As most of you know, I was away for a week or so. A couple of weeks ago, I was away for a week and was back visiting my brother and sister in North Carolina, and also had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with Ajahn Yanako's parents, who moved into that area recently, past year. So that was very delightful to spend a mealtime and a bit of an afternoon with them. And I also had the opportunity to meet up with an old friend from junior high, high school, with whom I had never had contact since that time. So 50 years almost had passed. And last year, with another friend of hers, another schoolmate actually, one who I knew from grade school even, they remained good friends and were in the process of doing some tracking down of old schoolmates. And after what I hear was a fairly lengthy search on the internet, they found out where I was, and even with a name change since my high school days, tracked me down last year. And we made contact. And it turns out that she's working on a project that is going through and interviewing a number of our classmates in the high school class of 1973 to kind of journal the experiences that we had in that class. It was a very significant time, you know, in a way, in the history of the schools of the South, where I grew up, North Carolina, Durham, North Carolina. And it was the year I entered high school, 10th grade, for the 10th, 11th, and 12th grades, was the year that finally, after a lot of delays, the integration of the schools in North Carolina started to take place, the desegregation that the Supreme Court had ruled on many years before. It was finally being implemented, and it was a very significant time in the cultural history of Durham and the city schools. And as it turned out, there were two high schools within the city limits of Durham, and one of them was predominantly white, one of them was predominantly black. And the court ruling aimed to equalize those more. And through, you know, busing, transportation, that kind of a thing, the neighborhoods were divided to try and provide more of a mix in those two high schools. So I lived in a neighborhood that went to the was assigned to the formerly all-black high school, and ended up going to that high school starting in the 10th grade. And it ended up being a mix of about, it still wasn't a complete 50-50 integration, but it was about 75% black, 25% white. So for the first time, I got to experience what it was like to be as a racial minority, at least during the school hours, because the neighborhood still remained segregated. But it was such a significant time that she thought, before too many years pass by and too many of us die, that she should get some recollections of this and turn it into kind of a project, and spent some time researching how to do that and what some useful information, and then started the process of hunting people down to interview. So she found me, I had certainly remembered her as a person that I went to school with and wasn't in the closest circle of friends that I had, but certainly I knew her and appreciated her presence in school. And we met just that past couple of weeks ago after having a series of emails. And as it turns out, I have agreed to go ahead and be interviewed, and our interview is scheduled for, I think, next week or the next week after that over Zoom. But we talked about many things. In the process, though, really kind of explored some of the old memories, looked at photo books, high school albums that I, you know, hadn't seen pictures of these people for, well, even since that time at all. And also, she happened to have some old photos, just casual photos, not yearbook photos, of a few of us at various events. And she found a couple of photos with myself in them at about the age of 15, 16 years old with some of the other classmates. And I was looking at them, and they were around a particular event or gathering that I had absolutely no memory of. And the people that I was in the photograph with, you know, several of them I recognized, a number of them I didn't even recognize or remember. And it was clear that I was having a good time and enjoying myself, as it looked like the others were. But the memories had faded so much. And like I said, I didn't even recognize the event that they were from. And as we talked and kind of reminisced and talked about various people that we remembered from school, I started to reflect after that whole thing about how changeable and malleable the past is when we go back and look at it from the present moment. And it was interesting. Like one of the people in one of the photographs was a fellow that had been in my neighborhood since probably maybe the age of 7 or 8. And my memory of that time was that, you know, in a sense, both he and I were kind of awkward awkward kids, you know, not feeling, I think, you know, perfectly at home in our lives, in our certainly not home in our bodies and minds, but just that kind of awkward feeling of not fitting in. And I kind of kept myself at a bit of a distance from this particular fellow who was in the neighborhood and maybe wasn't always as kind as I should have been, or understanding, probably became over-identifying with the same characteristics and being uncomfortable with them. So I don't remember having had a very close relationship, but then in the photograph, 5 or 6 or 7 years later, when we were both 15 and 16, clearly he was looking happy and having a good time. I was looking happy and having a good time, and I started to think to myself, well, maybe we were better friends than I thought, because I didn't remember that incident at all in the later years of getting together, and you know, maybe, you know. Maybe I wasn't as insensitive as I remembered being. And I started to realize that I was making up the past, in a sense, recreating the past to help fit a perception of how I would have liked to have been, the way I would have wanted it to have been had I been a bit more aware and more sensitive, more compassionate. And it just brought to mind the malleability and the changeability of looking into the past and bringing up memories and remembering events. And I also remember a few years ago reading an article about how memories are really, really unreliable, and how there was a study done with people witnessing auto accidents. And several people at the same time, at the same accident, witnessing the event, when interviewed not too much after the event, you know, like within that day, had very different perceptions of what actually happened, who was at fault, the sequence of events of people and the arrival of officers, all those kinds of things. People had very different perceptions of what happened, and they were all there at the same time watching the same thing. And then they also tracked it over time, and not only did those, you know, were those perceptions between different people changing, but people's memories of the event, also individuals' memories of the event over time changed as well. So not only do you have different perceptions at the time of the event, but you also have different perceptions some years later as the memories change. As the various states of mind that we all go through recreate the past, recreate the memories, so that it really calls into question the reliability of memories. And, you know, we can think about that sometimes. We have things happen in our lives with the people that we live with, and we have conversations, different perceptions, and different memories, and how certain we can be. How absolutely, positively certain that this was the way something happened, or this was what, he or she said in the conversation that we had, and this was how it was understood, and you know, how many conversations have we said, oh no, I'm absolutely certain that this is the way it was, or have we've heard other people say that, oh no, I'm clear, I'm very clear this is the way it was. Well, was it? You know, but you know, we can become so solidified in our perceptual process, and it's usually based on some underlying condition, underlying tendency that we have to want to see things in a certain way, want to experience things in a certain way, particularly our own self-impressions of who we are and how we speak, how we act. And we can create very clear, certain, definite memories of events that are very clearly and certainly different from other people's perceptions of it. So just recognizing that that's part of the perceptual process is very much colored by these underlying tendencies towards wanting to be seen in a certain way or wanting to be heard in a certain way, wanting to see in ourselves certain qualities and not see in ourselves other qualities that perhaps are underlying our body and our speech and our thinking. So to take memories with a certain grain of salt and to be willing to be open to the fact that these are manufactured realities. We often live in a completely manufactured reality, an illusion of sorts. This is what the process of perception, sanya, is all about. It's trying to take input from the world, contact through the senses, including the mind base, and weaving a certain reality to it so that it's comprehensible to us as human beings. And so we need this perceptual process to do that, to make a sense of cohesion around our experience so that we're not just constantly randomly responding to sights, sounds, tastes, etc., thoughts in a random way. So we classify, we organize, but it's all based on these underlying tendencies and who's in charge. You know, whether it's desire or attraction or wanting, or whether it's aversion or irritation or confusion, anxiety, fear, whatever the underlying tendency is that's activated at a particular time is what's in charge of how we organize our perceptions, organize our memories, organize and create our reality. So we have to be very growingly aware of what's going on underneath. It's conditioning our perceptual process, particularly looking at the past and retrieving memories and realizing that it may, you know, be very different from someone else's memory and the way that even we perceived it at some point or experienced it. And to be humbled by that, you know, to not take ourselves quite so literally, try and take our memories not so seriously, not so literally. And to see how that also operates with our projections into the future, manufacturing a possible reality for ourselves based on our wants and desires and fears and aversions, how projections into the future can take on that same kind of fabricated, manufactured reality that seems so possible and seems so real. Like, you know, maybe at some point in our lives, creating a fantasy of what, say, the perfect health, having perfect health would be, or what we need to do to keep the body living in a completely healthy, never get sick, kind of not really looking towards the realistic demise of this body eventually, and creating this sense of idealism around how to be healthy, how to eat, food preferences, what we think we need to maintain a healthy life, how we exercise, all those kinds of things, and then creating this ideal scenario. Okay, if I do all of these kinds of things, then this will happen and everything will be great. Or projecting into the future the perfect relationship. You know, how many years do some people spend looking for the ideal partner to live out their lives with in perfect harmony and growth, and, you know, not only the physical appearance of someone you find attractive, trying to find that ideal person, but personality traits that will be completely 100% compatible with you ideals and goals, and you know, just searching for that partner that will be everything that you need and will fulfill all the desires and projections that we have of living happily ever after forever with our healthy bodies that we've already created too. So fantasies, projections, creation of realities in our head, or the perfect job, the perfect career that will be ultimately satisfying, you know, be of use in the world and maybe even give us this promise of financial stability into old age, such that we never have to worry about money or possessions or comfort, any of those kinds of things, the perfect financial arrangement. All of these things that we project into the future and set up as an ideal that we try and actualize. We live our lives out. Some people live their lives out in this pursuit of creating an optimum ideal reality and then trying to work to optimize it and fulfill it. Creating those same kinds of ideals in society, cultural, sociocultural ideals, like perfect equality along all the lines of gender, race, sexuality, everything that you can possibly think of, so that there's no injustice in the world, there's no inequality in any way whatsoever, kind of the utopian cultural society. And seeing how that establishing of an ideal, starting from an idea of goodness, moving into an ideal of, you know, this is the way it should be, and then oftentimes moving into ideology of here is a structure that will make it so that, you know, these ideals are actualized. And the amount of expectation that we have by creating and living in that world. And it doesn't mean that we don't, when we have the abilities and the wherewithal to create goodness and fairness, justice, that we don't take those opportunities. But how we hold it and how much we invest in it turning out exactly the way that we visualize that it should be is where we set ourselves up for suffering if it doesn't come out, if it doesn't work out that the way we expect it. But it's all this process, again, of creating this manufactured reality, except it's one that we're projecting into the future rather than living in from past memory. It's the same process, though. And then how we bring it into present moment experience, too, that even in the present moment, we experience the world through the lens of our underlying tendencies of greed, hatred, and delusion, and how even one interaction, depending on the underlying state of one's mind, can be experienced in different ways. You know, so somebody says something to you in a, you know, what might be perceived as a kind of a terse way or maybe some sort of criticism, and depending on where you're at, becomes the reality of that whole exchange. So if you're, you know, feeling kind of down, or if aversion is lurking underneath there fairly close to the surface and somebody says something critical, then immediately the experience is one of feeling irritated or feeling somewhat angry. And if we're not careful, then we respond in likewise fashion. Or the same comment, the same incident, the same interaction, if you're feeling fairly understanding or patient or spacious or kind, you know, you've been practicing a lot of metta bhavana and patience and spaciousness, and you're feeling pretty good about things, and somebody comes along and does exactly the same thing as in the previous incident, and the response is like, oh, wow, this person's having a difficult time. Can I be open to that? Or can I listen? Can I hear? Can I be spacious with that? And not, you know, not react in a difficult way, not to hold it and cling to it in that way with irritation or aversion. But same thing, but the mood of the mind, the state of mind, totally determines our experience of the same event. Or if the underlying tendency is one of anxiety or fear, we just are confused. And what happened there. Same event, different response. So this is the world of perception, the world of creation, and we pretty much, until we start to get a handle on these kinds of perceptions and the conditioning that we bring to them, we walk around in this fog of manufactured realities, totally based on our own underlying mind states. So the task is starting to discover how we can see things more clearly and how we can be aware of these processes that are happening without getting sucked into them and living through them. And this is what the practice is all about, the Noble Eightfold Path, particularly the path of, as it matures into reflection, settling of the mind, so that we can start to see the nature of reality along the lines of Dhamma rather than the lines of conditioning. So this is where, as the mind starts to settle and be more peaceful, we can look at events with clarity and not so much confusion, to develop that sense of clear comprehension. The Buddha, in some of the suttas, in some of the teachings, describes clear comprehension as being able to see feelings as they arise, as they persist, and as they pass away. Being able to see perceptions as they arise, as they persist, and as they pass away. And being able to see thoughts as they arise, as they persist, and as they pass away. This is sampajanya, clear comprehension. So we're starting to look at the world of our memories and our perceptions through the lens of anicca and dukkha and anatta, the three characteristics. And see how we get entranced by them, how we get enchanted by these very transient kinds of mental experiences and create realities. And we start to tease that apart and see it much more clearly. We don't get sucked into it under the influence of our underlying habits of mind. And this is the process of discernment starting to manifest. But we have to have a clear enough mind to be able to turn our attention in that direction, not buy into the forces of wanting, of aversion, of confusion, not to buy into those forces that color how we see things, but to really cultivate putting our attention on the calming and the discernment aspects that we have as potentials that we just need to cultivate, develop, and start to witness our reality through those perceptions, and to see how our experiences can be totally transformed into that clarity of not being fooled by the illusion that we've created, that we manifest ourselves into. We can start to see the world as it really is around us, not through the lens of our underlying tendencies, our defilements, but through the lens of wisdom, of clarity, and to learn to respond to them in a skillful way with that clarity of wisdom, and bringing in aspects of kindness and compassion, generosity, all the virtues that make a human life livable and make society much more harmonious. But the clarity of clear seeing, clear understanding is the primary important one. And it gives rise to what the Buddha calls jnana-dasana, knowledge and vision of the way things really are, rather than the illusory process that we usually live our lives through. So knowledge and vision of the way of reality, the way things really are in the teachings of the Buddha. And then that gives rise to this nibbita. We chanted that sutta tonight, the fire sermon, talking about how all of the sense experiences and the mental responses to the sense experiences, we start to see those clearly in their true nature. And when that happens, the enchantment that we've been living under, the veil of a distorted reality, is lifted. And all of a sudden, the world is a whole lot clearer. You know, we can appreciate this on a conceptual level, but, you know, to really experience that is just a major turn in how we perceive and how we operate in the world. And the Buddha's famous saying, you know, for however it is conceived, for however it is that we conceive it, it is always other than that. So that our conceptions create this world of perceptions that we live through and constantly reinforce. But this jnana-dasana through our practice, this clear seeing, the sampajanya, clear awareness, is what gives rise to wisdom and our potential for not engaging, not being enchanted. And this is what I think is meant by nibbida, disenchantment. There is a quality of turning away from that comes from this disenchantment, but it's also more like, in my mind, the veil of the illusion, the enchantment being pulled off. This is the disenchantment, which comes from that clear knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. So this is the emotional response, the internal affective response to wisdom, is that veil being lifted and the clarity that gives rise to dispassion. Just, wow, you know, I don't need to do this anymore. I don't need to follow these impulses that just keep taking me into confusion and manufacture this reality that isn't really very solid or very real. I can let that go, and I can turn towards what the Buddha calls the unconditioned, the relinquishment of the whole sense of me and mine in relation to the world, the khandhas, as Lungpa was talking about in his recent talks. He's really seeing the illusions of self in relation to our body and our mind. And this disenchantment, this dispassion, this turning away from, relinquishing of this confusion to clarity and to release, and the freedom in the heart that comes from that. So we turn from the actual investigation of the phenomena in our experience and learn to just release, relinquish, let go as we witness the arising and passing away of the world as we've created it. And this is where the real freedom lies, because as much as we can try and create pleasant realities through memories and skillful action, the true ending of the cycles of greed, hatred, delusion, the true ending comes from complete relinquishment of being fooled by the promises of our habits, the promises of how we usually see the world, the ideals, how ideas of goodness start to turn to ideals of this is the way it should be, turn to ideologies of like systems that have to be a certain way, even monastic living, monastic communities. We have ideals about, okay, I'm going to give up the world and get off this crazy vehicle that I've been riding and trying to steer with not much hope. I'm going to chuck it all and go to the monastery and practice the way to get out of it all. And then we create an ideal of what monastic life is and what a monastery should be and the people living in it. And we start to realize that that's another manufactured creation too, that we have to see through the illusion. We use it as a tool, as a vehicle, but we don't invest a perfect reality onto it. We don't impose that sense of it will be perfection. As Ajahn Chah told a visitor who was going from monastery to monastery, looking for the perfect teacher, looking for the perfect situation, you know, and was sure that he finally found it with Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah's comment being something along the lines of, well, you know, what you're looking for is a turtle with a mustache. You won't ever find one because it doesn't exist. And you'll find fault with me at some point, too. So, you know, we can even do that kind of sense of creation of the perfect scenario with monastic life. So to just be wary of that as we begin our search for truth. But then in the end, even with these realizations and this shift of perception. We still find ourselves in the world. And so again, you know, with all the skill and knowledge we can, when the opportunities arise to create goodness, to create justice, to create fairness and help to right the injustices, the right the wrongs of the world, we do so with that sense of wisdom and realize that there are things that we have some influence over and some things that we don't. And we act on the ones that we can. But always keeping in mind that we need to keep the clarity and wisdom ignited in our own lives so that whatever actions we do take come from that clear, open, knowing quality. So this is where we can find peace in ourselves, peace in our own hearts, and a very long-lasting peace that's not subject to the vicissitudes of samsara. It's looking towards the unconditioned and operating from that sense of clear knowing, you know, always remembering, you know, Ajahn Sumedho's refrain, encouragement for us to view our experience, our current present moment experience of, you know, it's like this. This is the way it is. We don't have to project anything onto it, just to know it simply as it is. And to know that deeply, not just as a nice saying, but to really take that to heart and bring that to all moments of our present moment experience. So I'll just leave it there for tonight's reflection.